Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 325 of the Fun with Cars Motorsport Podcast, or episode 12 of 2022. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man who just bought a boat at the Miami parking lot harbor for a great price, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Handles really well in fake marinas.
Yeah, I've heard that it's remarkably solid. Like, you don't feel any rocking of the boat or anything.
None at all.
It is Wednesday afternoon, May 10th, and Chris and I are going to be talking about the Miami Grand Prix. But Chris, where would you like to start? Do you have news you want to talk about, or some fun facts, or any other interesting tidbits?
There's not that much news. I will comment on the fact that there have been quite a few articles and videos released commemorating the 40th anniversary of Gilles Villeneuve's death at Zolder in qualifying for the Belgian Grand Prix. There's been some good reminiscing going on by some of his compatriots. I think Charles Leclerc was filmed driving one of Gilles' cars.
It's at the T312, am I remembering correctly?
I think you're right, yes. So, obviously, he was a very iconic racing driver, sort of the absolute distillation of all things racing into one individual. So there was never any consideration for, you know, looking after his car or not going flat out. It was always a total commitment from Gilles. And there are some truly iconic racing scenes or footage out there on YouTube and other places if you want to go and check that out. He was quite the committed racing driver and a firm Ferrari favorite to this day.
And he was quite young when he passed. He was still in his 20s, wasn't he?
Well, pretty young, but he was 32, I think.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess he was married with the son and all that, wasn't he?
Yeah, your favorite all-time racing driver, Jacques Villeneuve.
Yeah, the GOAT. The GOAT, as I like to call him here in this house.
So, obviously, it's been a long time, but certainly, you know, some very iconic early Formula One footage from the 80s always includes Gilles.
Yeah, I mean, and I think your description of him early was perfect. I mean, just fully committed to motorsport and just uncompromising to a level that I'm not sure we've seen since. Just everything was all or nothing with him, and that level of commitment to not even just motorsport, but to just life was such a standout, unique, amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. He invented a whole new ladder to get into Formula One that started with snowmobile racing. Now, most people do go-karting, but Gilles started out snowmobile racing that eventually led to cars and Formula
that
One.
That is such a Canadian thing. That is pure. Yes, it's like, yeah, well, once we're done with ice hockey, we're going to go down that. And I think they prefer the term snow machines, but who cares? And we'll get on the snow machine and go right around, eh?
No one else has followed that particular ladder.
Perfect Canadian accent there.
Yeah, it's uncanny. Yeah, no one else has followed him on that particular ladder, I think, since. But he was into his helicopters. He was into his power boats. There's some great stories circulating of people who made the mistake of getting a lift to or from a racetrack with him, subsequently terrified. He was full on. He lived life absolutely to the fullest. So you got to give him credit for that.
I think it's actually, he does remind me of another Canadian driver, but another driver that had that kind of like level of commitment to a certain extent. And that was Paul Tracy. Paul Tracy kind of lived that way. And there is an American that he's reminding me of as well, who still races to this day. He just keeps going. I have huge respect for him as well. Bill Auberlin. He's kind of like just flat out in everything he does and loves racing and continues, still races now, even though he's matured since a bit since his start.
Very cool. So always worth checking out some of the historic racing footage, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, just to put a point on it, Bill Auberlin is 54, so and still going strong. And here's a fun little tidbit: 54 was the age Mario Andretti was when he retired from IndyCar racing full time. So there you go, fun little tidbits, and potential for another corrections next week.
So here's a question for you, Robin. On the hypometer, where did Miami Grand Prix stand? Was it, you know, downplaying it? This is just a new event. We've got to earn our place in Formula One. Or was it, we are the greatest F1 race ever to have occurred. We're here, we're proud, we're loud, and we are going to nail it. Where do you think
it
stands?
Which one is a 1 and which one is a 10, sir?
Well, I think it goes from 1 to about a trillion, actually. It used to be a 10-point scale, but Miami's moved that to a trillion.
the hype was really something. I mean, credit to the people that put it together. It did not look like a parking lot. You've heard it from me officially. I've said it, and I will stand by it. They definitely did more than just pull the temporary curbs and wash over the parking spot lines. I mean, that it looked like a racetrack. So,
agree.
I mean, there were awkward moments here and there, but you know what I'm saying. And then just the amount of attention that place got in terms of celebrity appearances. And like from the musical side, from the, you know, actor side, from the sports side, and then other, I mean, all kinds of things were played up. There was an interview between, it was one of the Formula One commentators, but then Tom Brady and Lewis Hamilton playing golf together. And then the three of them sat down for an interview after that. It's like, he's a 7-time Super Bowl winner. Tom Brady is, and Lewis Hamilton, obviously 7-time champion. So there's those kinds of things going on. And then leading up to the race, I'm listening to Martin Brundle interview DJ Khaled, of all people. Way, way out of his sorts, Martin Brundle was. And DJ Khaled, way, way out of his sorts when it comes to Formula One. It was such a bizarre thing. And then, of course, there's just one celebrity after another that was there. The Williams, Serena and Venus Williams were there, and on and on and on. It was endless.
Yes, that's right. I'm going to go on record that for sure the track was a remarkable effort. I mean, it would be hard pressed to actually, you know, realize it was a temporary track. Honestly, it was such a good job. And yeah, you got to say the layout. I know there were some complaints about the actual track surface itself from some of the drivers.
The surface and the configuration, there's a couple, I have my issues with those things, but continue.
But yeah, in the main, it's not a bad effort, I think, and far better than we were expecting, and far better than the last effort at Caesar's Palace. But I don't think I really need all the celeb activity, honestly. You know, whether they're there or not really makes no difference to my enjoyment of a Grand Prix weekend. And I appreciate that that's not the same for everybody else. But for me, it adds absolutely nothing to the event whatsoever.
Well, what was frustrating to me was that it was very much feeding into the American stereotype around the world, I felt. This, like, bigger, glitzier, glamorous, more celebrities, more energy, and, you know, just everything's a packed crowd, everything's super hot. And I do think, literally, Paris Hilton was there, speaking of such terms. And it diluted the fact that there are tons and tons of huge road racing fans in the United States, massive road racing fans.
Well, what fills me with some level of trepidation is the fact that next year we'll have Vegas on the calendar. So Vegas is now going to have to try and top the Miami effort. And now we're going to have this battle between the two cities over the next 10 years. That's going to be tremendous. I mean, imagine how remarkable it could be in 10 years' time. We might have people landing by a SpaceX rocket prior to the grid walk. I mean, who knows what they're going to come up with?
Yeah, none of which will carpet or something or a magic act in the middle. Who knows? But that's just it. You lay too much theater on top of it, and it takes away from the motorsport. I mean, Coda put on some of that American bigger is betterness, but the motorsport was proper and pure and obviously still the main highlight. Miami started skirting the lines of that a little bit. And even, you know, having Danica Patrick join Martin Brundle and Jensen Button Simon, I think it is. Oh, that's frustrating. I don't remember his name. The usual team for Formula One for the pre-race and post-race shows.
Yeah.
And she obviously knows motorsport really well, but it was also, to me, pretty apparent that she doesn't track Formula One all that closely. Do you know what I mean? And that was frustrating because, again, there's lots of very knowledgeable people about Formula One in the United States.
Yeah, I didn't hear or watch all of that. I did catch the questions she asked to the top three qualifiers, and I didn't think that those questions were particularly egregious. I mean, I thought they were fairly sensible. I don't have a problem with local people asking questions, you know, post-qualifying or post-race, because having the same interviewers every time gets a bit dull. And I know there was quite a lot of response to Willie T. Ribbs's questions post the race. Some people liked it and some people didn't. But
I liked it. I'll say that I liked his approach. You know, he was fist bumping them. He was just like kind of like racer to racer respect kind of thing going on. I liked that part of it quite a lot. And I mean, Willie T. Ribbs has Formula One experience, and the fact that he tested, I think it was a Brabham back in the 70s.
Yeah, and, yeah, I think we talked about that
last
year.
He has a lot of positive things to say about Formula One.
Yeah, so that type of localization, I think that's good, honestly. As long as you find the right individuals to do it, and both of those have got racing pedigree, and it's nice to have Danica add a little bit of variety, right? It's not another chap, white ex-Formula One racers, usually from Britain, because there is a bit of a theme, right? You have Brundle or Coulthard doing quite a lot of those, both in the same country, similar background. So it's good to have some other people do it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they venture out and have a Scot instead of an Englishman, but yeah.
Well, that's DC, yeah, David Coulthard, yeah.
No, I was thinking of Dario Franchitti's nephew.
Paul DiResta does it occasionally.
DiResta, yeah. But no, and I'm Danica certainly, again, she has the credentials, and she actually, one of her first big debuts in a larger motorsport was the British Formula Ford Festival, and she competed very well there. So she even has a little bit of European racing experience. And she wasn't egregious. I'm certainly not suggesting that. But she was, I think the best way to describe it is she kept it very surface level. She was not at all interested in digging deep in any particular topic. She just kept it highlights and brushing along the surface and speaking in generalities. And I think there was the missed opportunity there, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, but what would you expect? She, as you said, she's never really been associated with F1. And she, you know, whether or not she follows the sport closely enough to really get into the minutiae is probably unlikely. So, but yeah, she does have, you know, pretty solid racing pedigree, and she had quite a bit of success in single seaters, and I certainly don't have a problem with including her. Whether or not you could go pick someone else from the US racing scene that might have been a bit more authoritative, you probably could, but I don't have an issue with that. I don't think she did a bad job.
I'll take Danica Patrick as part of the team over Martin Brundle interviewing DJ Khaled any day. DJ Khaled promoted Miami, and that's fine. Good for him. And, you know, the fact that he was there to show interest was good. But, I mean, yeah. We need to move on. I'm dragging on in this. I apologize. But the fact that Drive to Survive has increased interest in Formula One in the United States is good. But trying to add too much of this Americana-ness stereotypical Americana-ness onto it is less good, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I think Austin's always done a very good job of walking that line between playing up the fact that, you know, they've basically been the US Grand Prix for the majority of the last few years, but also...
Yeah, the debut race was 2012.
Yeah, but also, you know, they were always dedicated to providing a proper, genuine track and experience for F1 to be, a proper F1 race. And they've achieved that brilliantly. It's a great race at Austin, and it's a great experience at Austin. I worry that Miami and potentially Vegas are going to lose that balance. But, you know, again, I think Miami overall wasn't bad. And I ignored the stuff I wasn't interested in and just caught the bits I was. So it's perfectly possible to pick your poison.
Yes. And, you know, there's a lark to the fact that they set up their own little fake harbor. Like, we can have a harbor, too. I mean, credit for creativity there. It's like, well, people like it when there's yachts next to the edge of the track because it's on the harbor. So let's just trailer in some boats. Fine. And, you know, they had some interesting concepts with, you know, outdoor swimming pools around the tracks and these types of things that had some clever aspects to it. But I was a little bit ho-hum about the racetrack itself. I felt it was a touch milquetoast. 3 DRS zones, and even with that, not tons of passing.
They are still constrained, you know, by the space they have at their disposal. I know they've got a main road on one side, they've got a canal on the other. They are, you know, so that limits the width, and obviously they're having to circulate around. Again, given those constraints, I think they did a pretty decent job. Was it the all-time greatest racetrack we've ever seen? No, it's not Spa-Francorchamps Mark II, is it? It's not Road America. It's not Laguna Seca. It's none of those things.
It's not Sebring either, Sebring is another very flat place. But Sebring is epic, and this was not epic.
But you're forgetting the fact that they had the world's biggest podium, Robin. That more than compensates, surely.
Yes, you're right. I apologize. I forgot.
Should we talk about Mercedes?
Let's talk about the weekend itself. We should talk about Mercedes. They did bring updated equipment, and it seemed to be bearing fruit on Friday, but then less so when it got to Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, they brought new front and rear wings and a new rear beam wing. So trying to reduce the drag of the car. And on Friday, it looked like it had created something of a breakthrough with Russell and Hamilton, both pretty quick in FP1 and 2. Of course, you know, the track was pretty green on Friday, and it evolved considerably over the course of the weekend. Most teams went about a second quicker from Saturday prior to Friday, and Mercedes did not. They just stood still, and even though they ran exactly the same setup, the porpoising somehow magically returned on Saturday.
As the track rubbered in, I don't know if that was the cause
definitely
of
a factor.
That they were having faster exit speeds and started just getting into that, you know, that window for it again, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what people are speculating. So, it wasn't obviously the magic bullet they were searching for, and they seem to be a little bit lost. I think Spain will be a big, big test for Mercedes, because they'll be able to compare the performance of this new updated chassis with the vehicle that they ran in the original Barcelona test, because there's some discussion that they may go back to their first version, which still had fairly wide side pods on it and a more traditional radiator housing than the very zero side pod car they're running at the moment. So they look a little lost. I mean, their performance in qualifying, I mean, Hamilton qualified sixth, so not a disaster. I mean, the car is still there or thereabouts in the best of the rest group. And then, you know, both Russell and Hamilton had a good race on Sunday, with Russell continuing his lucky safety car form, but doing really well on the hard tyres from the beginning to manage to snag fifth over Hamilton, both just beating Bottas, who was very quick in the Alfa Romeo all weekend, to his credit. So they still salvaged a decent result, given where they are with this car, but they are miles off getting closer to Red Bull and Ferrari at this point. Their updates did not really, you could argue, weren't that successful.
Ultimately, at the end of Sunday, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it kept them from falling further behind, potentially, but it certainly was not progressing forward. Also, Red Bull had a really fascinating weekend, and that might have potentially played into the appearance of Mercedes having a better Friday. They really struggled on Friday, seemed to start turning things around on Saturday, but not completely. But then their Sunday, obviously, went just fine.
Yeah, I mean, Verstappen had very limited running on Friday. They had hydraulic issues that basically gave him just, I think, a couple of laps over the course of the two free practices. And it was remarkable that he was able to qualify third, despite being at a new track and only really getting out in FP3, which is a little bit ominous for everyone else, particularly Ferrari. The fact that they, Max had so many issues, and yet they still were able to win the Grand Prix fairly easily, really. But Perez also had problems, didn't he? He had problems with his power unit in the race, and which he thinks, prevented him from really attacking Carlos for the podium, and potentially Charles as well.
They had to, the way it was described over the commentary, there was an issue with a sensor, and to correct the issue that was really hurting him was they failed the sensor. But by doing that, that did end up, I think they were saying it cost them somewhere towards 20 kilowatts of power, which is, I think they were, right. I'd have to do the math. I'm not too good at doing it in my head, but it was like better than 25 horsepower. And that was, so that was hurting them a little bit, because the Red Bull strength, of course, is straight line speed. And if you're taking away horsepower, you're taking away straight line speed. But just as you said, even with those issues, they were first and fourth, at the end of the race weekend. And here it was, Ferrari looked strong on Friday, really strong on Saturday, qualifying 1-2, Leclerc ahead of Sainz. But, and then the race pace just was not there for them. Cornering speed didn't even seem that much better than Red Bull. And then Red Bull once again dominated straight line speed.
Yeah, I mean, Friday wasn't perfect, was it? Carlos managed to stick it in the wall, which just seemed to be continuing his terrible run of form of late, having not finished the prior two Grand Prix. But to be fair to him, he did bounce back in qualifying, did a good job to lock out the front row with Charles on pole. And it all looked really good for Ferrari at that point. But as you said, right from the beginning of the race, Carlos was powerless to stop Max getting past him, and then it always looked like Charles was struggling to keep him at bay. And obviously we've seen that the Ferrari seems to go through its tyres faster than the Red Bull. So he had graining on, I think, the front right tyre again, as he did at Imola.
Which is totally counterintuitive to what we've been learning. Red Bull faster in the straights, Ferrari faster in the corners. Less downforce on the Red Bull, more on the Ferrari. You'd think that that would hurt tire wear for Red Bull, not help it. So that there seems to be some just not fully understood circumstances that are really hurting Ferrari race pace compared to Red Bull. Is that fair, would you say?
I'm not sure you could say race pace. I think if you look at, when either Charles was leading or Max was leading, especially after the safety car, the pace was very, very even between them. But certainly the tyre wear on the Ferrari seems to be worse, or the tyre deg is greater on the Ferrari than the Red Bull. And then, as you've been saying, the straight line advantage that Red Bull has is massive. So, Charles can have a fairly speculative punt for an overtake because of the better straight line speed, whereas Charles really has no hope once he's behind. He just doesn't have the straight line pace, even with DRS, to have a real legitimate chance of a pass. So he has to stay in front, really. And, you know, he wasn't even that defensive. He sort of let Max go fairly easily. He didn't fight that. Maybe he thought he was going to get back at him later on the lap, but that didn't work out at all. So it was a bit of a weak race day performance by both Charles and Carlos. Disappointing.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I guess what surprised me is even early in the race when we're on fresher tires, I expected the Ferrari to pull away further in the corners than they did. And, you know, at the very first few laps of the race, Leclerc was able to pull enough of a gap to not give Verstappen DRS. And then maybe this was tire wear a little bit, but it wasn't that long, maybe 10 laps in, that Verstappen started reeling Leclerc into DRS zone. And then it was game over. And then even in the corners, Verstappen was holding his own and then just rocketing down the straight.
Yeah, I mean, some of those low-speed corners may not really have played into the Ferrari strengths, right? So that may have helped the relative pace of the Red Bull. But I think, you know, if you listen to what Matteo Binotto was saying post-race, he's very concerned with the frequency and the quantity of upgrades that Red Bull are bringing so far after, you know, round five. And he basically made the comment that he doesn't understand how they can continue to do that. That if they continue to do that, they'll have to be quick.
With the budget
questions
cap
raised. Exactly. He's like, well, yeah, how on earth can they be doing this? And so, you know, a lot of the teams are saying, well, you can't just keep throwing parts on every race weekend. You basically really got to maximize the upgrade within the budget and limitations. So I know Ferrari will be bringing upgrades to Spain, but I think his point is going to be he'll go to the FIA if Red Bull just keep constantly tweaking and adding new bits and pieces, because the numbers don't add up in his book. So
that's a good point. And I remember quite consciously and publicly, Mercedes were like, I guess we're not bringing upgrades to Italy. We're going to wait because it's more efficient financially to do it later.
Right. Right, exactly. And, you know, remember that Ferrari should have more wind tunnel time than Red Bull this year because they finished behind them in the Constructors' Championship last year. You would think in this battle, you know, Mercedes gets the least, Red Bull the second most, Ferrari will get the next amount. So they should have an advantage in wind tunnel time as well. So same budget, that's fixed. More wind tunnel time or CFD time. So you would think in a development race, Ferrari should have an advantage, but right now it's not seemingly playing out that way.
Yeah, no, and that's a really good point. And that's really fascinating because there's the pace of the car over a single lap. Then there's the pace of the car over a stint in between pit stops. Then the full race, but then also the championship. And that might be something we pay close attention to, is Red Bull overdeveloping early on. Is that going to hurt them when we get to the, you know, final quarter of the season when other teams still have budget for more updated parts and Red Bull doesn't? Or do other teams start accusing Red Bull of cheating?
Yeah. I mean, it is logical to spend the money early on and throw the parts on the car sooner rather than later, right? You want to get your car as competitive as possible, as early as possible in the season. And then you want to get as many points on the board as possible. There's no point in saving everything up for the last race when the championship's already gone, is there? So there's a lot of strategy and planning that will go into this. And it doesn't surprise me that some teams might front load it. And they'll basically get to a point where they've run out of budget and they can't do any more upgrades at some point in the season. But presumably by that point, they will have refined it and optimized it as much as they can. So, that's another layer of strategy that's going to go on throughout the year. It's going to be fascinating to see who does it the most effective way. I think At the end of the day, though, after five rounds, Ferrari leading both championships, and 19 points is still a healthy margin in anyone's book for Charles over Max. And sure, Max has now won three races versus Charles's two. But, you know, you have to say that Charles is still very much in the mix and has been competitive in pretty much every Grand Prix this year. So, you know, for Ferrari fans from where they were just a couple of seasons ago, I mean, this is still a pretty decent situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it's amazing how short people's memories can be when it comes to this kind of stuff.
yeah, that's true.
So you mentioned earlier Bottas continuing to show that the Alfa Romeo Orlean is a potent machine as well, qualifying in the top five and finishing in the points again. Zhou isn't really there, but he's not totally out of touch. He's just not quite to Bottas's pace. Is there anything more you want to say about Bottas or anybody else that you think we should talk about?
Well, clearly he likes out qualifying the Mercedes in his Alfa Romeo. I thought he just was, it was just absolutely textbook Bottas, wasn't it? Qualifying, outstanding performance, right? In the race, he seemed to have it under control, but then made a ludicrous error after the safety car slipped wide and allowed both Mercedes past. And it just was so Bottas.
It's true.
But no, I'm pleased that it's going well for him. I mean, he's still, you know, seventh place race result, not a bad effort at all. And it just shows that Alfa Romeo were pretty smart to sign him up because, as you said, I mean, Zhou was 17th on the grid, didn't finish. Although I don't think that was his fault. I think it was a reliability issue. But yeah, I mean, if you had maybe Kimi Räikkönen in the car, you know. I don't think he'd be qualifying. He would be necessarily qualifying in the top 10 because I think he'd lost a bit of pace. So Bottas is a really good yardstick for Alfa Romeo. And, again, this is a team that's been around in the sport for a long time now and seem to be falling into, you know, pretty dark days. And now they've got a whole new lease of life. So it's pretty cool to watch how they're going. And I still believe he has a chance to sneak a podium.
What did you think of McLaren, more specifically Ricciardo v. Lando, or I should say Norris v. Ricciardo, or Daniel v. Lando? You know what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, I think the highlight of their weekend was Lando's crash helmet, which was awesome. The basketball effect, I really like that. And then everything else was not great, was it? I mean, pace in qualifying wasn't ideal. Norris out-qualified by Gasly at the two Mercedes. Oh, sorry, only Hamilton out-qualified him, but also Bottas. So he seemed to slip down the order. McLaren didn't seem to be doing as well around that particular track. Danny struggled, you know, only 14th place, so he had some troubles. I think he had problems with his gearbox, but yeah, regardless, you know, not really on it. And then the race was just lamentable, wasn't it? I mean, I don't really understand the Gasly Norris crash, and I don't really understand why Gasly wasn't penalized more for it, other than because he had already had damage from Alonso hitting him, that was a mitigating situation. But to me, why he's not driving more slowly offline is beyond me. And you could argue maybe Norris was a bit lazy and not giving him a bit more room. But that was a pretty decent sized shunt. And obviously that caused the safety car, which livened up the sort of last part of the race. But not after a couple of good races, McLaren slipped back to the back half of the midfield, really.
Yeah. But real quickly, I mean, it was frustrating because Gasly had qualified, so the AlphaTauri was showing a little bit of life again. Gasly qualified P7, and it looked like maybe we might get a little bit more of that more recent, you know, AlphaTauri era Gasly performance, but then obviously not to be.
Yeah, and Tsunoda qualified 9th, so it's very strong qualifying for them, and then neither finished in the points. I mean, Alonso was like a wrecking ball, wasn't he? I mean, he was feisty at the start. I think he touched Hamilton, but neither of them suffered any damage. And then he had the contact with Gasly, which he admitted to, and then he cut the chicane later on in a failed effort to score some points. So he finished the Grand Prix in ninth and was actually beaten by his teammate who started from the pit lane. I mean, that's not good, is it? And then by the time you add his 2 5-second penalties, he slipped down to 11th. So Alonso seemed to be overdriving a little bit, I would suggest.
Yeah, potentially. So Mick Schumacher outqualified Kevin Magnussen for the first time.
He did, yeah. Yeah, they were next door to each other on the grid, weren't they? I think his weekend will be more remembered by hitting Sebastian Vettel, his mentor, than anything else, though.
Yeah, that wasn't ideal. The stewards deemed it a race incident, and I think ultimately they were right.
Yeah, I think so. I think it looked really bad initially that Schumacher had just done a late lunge, but it looks like Vettel was somewhat to blame. So, yeah, it was 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. They took each other out. Not ideal.
There's a single German word that means exactly what you just said. 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. It's Gorgon, Freigen, Slippen, Thocken.
First. Yes, exactly.
As you can see, my German is also textbook. I'm just so worldly.
It was a shame for Seb because he and Stroll, they were showing a bit of pace as well, weren't they? I mean, Stroll
looked pretty darn quick in a couple of spots.
Yeah, he qualified 10th, finished 10th. But what you may not appreciate if you weren't following closely was that he started from the back because they had a fuel irregularity issue. So he did a pit lane start as well.
Their fuel was too cold. And so they had to warm it up. It was a very bizarre, like, they cooled it so it wouldn't be too hot, but then it was too cold, and that would do something to, like, throw off some bits. Obviously, I don't know the detail or I'd be explaining it better, but largely the fuel was too cold to put into the car and make the grid. So they had to take time to warm up the fuel and then put fuel in, and then they had to start from the pit lane as a result. And that was both Stroll and Vettel.
Yeah, but I mean, let's overlook that disaster and poor planning. It would never have happened under Otmar, would it? Let's be honest. But the Martin Whitmarsh with his Logo Allardyce tea obviously was also chilling the fuel. But anyway, the bottom line is that Aston showed decent race pace. So they're making some strides there. And for Stroll to nick a point was a fair effort. Although he and Magnussen managed to hit each other. So both Hases unfortunately seemed to have magnetic properties over the weekend and kept colliding with other vehicles. So that ruined K-Mag's race. But Stroll somehow survived and got a point. But the guy I was really pleased for was Alex Albon again. 2 points, red hair, and he's just...
It was the hair. Just be honest with yourself.
I mean, they had an awful qualifying. I guess they really just couldn't get the tyres into the window, but the race pace seems pretty darn decent, quite frankly.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And again, this is an old trope of mine. I've brought it up several times before. But Alex is performing very, very well. Gasly, less so this year, but last year and the year before, performed very, very well. The teammates to Verstappen, when they get a second chance, are really shining. And so I think what that means is we have to take a step back and really say that Perez is doing a pretty darn hardy job maintaining some darn decent pace and showing more strengths this year than last. And that's a very hard seat to hold on to, that second Red Bull seat.
Yeah, he's doing a decent job, isn't he, Sergio? Sometimes the gap to Max is a little bit great, and you know, you still got a first and second division in the top two teams, right? I mean, Carlos and Sergio are not at the level that Max and Charles are performing at, but yeah, they're both doing a decent job, and I think Sergio is more of a known quantity. I think Red Bull are accepting the level he's performing at, but for sure, both Gasly and Albon deserve to be in Formula One. I mean, that there's no doubt about that. I mean, Gasly has driven some excellent races And done some fine performances since he's been out of the Red Bull seat, and now so is, you know, Alex is doing the same thing. So I'm glad they were able to find alternative seats. I don't know if it would even be in their interest to try and get back into Red Bull as long as Max is there. I think they're better off trying to find their own way, maybe for
Gasly
other teams.
Still desperately wants it. He's made that very clear.
Yeah, but we all know it's going to be another train wreck.
So is there anything else about the Miami Grand Prix you want to discuss before we move on?
I think, you know, it's tight in the championship. I think so, 6 points in the Constructors' Championship, Ferrari to Red Bull. And then Mercedes are, you know, pretty solidly in third, not really threatened for that.
Despite their performance on track, their Constructors' points look better than their on-track performance would suggest.
Well, Russell set a record for, you know, his fifth top five finish in a row. I think only Fangio's managed more, and I think he achieved 7 top five finishes in a row. Curious stat that, but that's one that caught my eye. So, you know, for all their troubles, they're still chalking up the points consistently. And that's why, you know, they're in a bit of no man's land. They're way ahead of McLaren, 49 points ahead of McLaren. But they are, 56 points behind Red Bull. So as it stands, they are destined for mediocrity. But it's, you know, considering their car's not working, it's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, they're making the most of their circumstances, I think, is the best way to put it. But, well, we've got a whole lot of racing coming towards us very soon. Up next... for Formula One is the Spanish Grand Prix, and that's the weekend of May 20th through the 22nd. And that one is going to be really fascinating. We're going from a brand new venue with kind of questionable surface and a whole lot of just hoopla tied to the event to the most detailedly understood racetrack in the Formula One calendar. So how do the cars stack up in Spain is going to be really, really interesting. And then that's going to be complicated and complemented by the fact that there will almost certainly be improvements to the cars across the board. And who makes the right decision and who has bigger gains or potential losses with their upgrades, that's coming on the 20th through the 22nd. That'll be really fascinating. IndyCar's month of May officially begins. We have the Indianapolis Road Course race coming this weekend. That's May 14th. It's actually a Saturday race. And then IMSA is going to Mid-Ohio on the 15th. That race is on a Sunday. And that one's going to be really fascinating because when I spoke with Ricky Taylor a couple episodes ago, he was saying that Mid-Ohio was another one of the tracks that the Orica is happy on, the car that started as the Orica. And so it'll be interesting to see if they can make it 2-for-2 there. So that's the race we've got coming up. But, oh, all of that, by a country mile, Chris, pales in comparison to my latest YouTube video. Oh, my goodness. I had a humdinger of a video, a cracker of sorts, an afternoon tease-worthy YouTube video. It was the Land Rover Defender, the new Defender. I got behind the wheel, and, boy, is that something.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much, Robin. You were as meticulous as ever in describing the Defender's tricks and features, and it was almost like I'd driven the vehicle myself.
Well, and you do, if I may be so boastful, you do own a Land Rover yourself. And did this make you have any, like, twinges to turn your Discovery in and pick up a Defender?
I am a Land Rover owner. I'm also a former Land Rover employee, so I am rather partial to the brand, I have to say. I don't know. If I get a new Land Rover, it won't be a Defender, but I do like it a lot. It is very cool. But yeah, they need to be offering at least a hybrid version to tempt me. And I know they are offering that in some of their new Range Rover Land Rovers.
Sure. Sir, the car I drove was, in fact, a hybrid kind, sir. It was a mild hybrid 48-volt system, but it was a hybrid nonetheless.
That's not a... It's not a hybrid. It's got to be a plug-in hybrid.
Mild hybrid counts. Hybrid's in the name. It counts.
Well, I mean, JLR has mild. They have PHEVs. They have pure EVs. I just read that the new Range Rover Sport's going to be offered as a pure EV. So they've got lots of good good cars coming. But when premium fuel costs almost $5 a gallon, that's what I'm looking for. So it's a bit more economical.
Well, you know, I've driven, it's funny because I've driven a few different hybrids. One of the more recent hybrids I drove was that plug-in hybrid Toyota RAV4 Prime. But two of my recent hybrids, and I'm using the word in the technical sense, was this Land Rover Defender mild hybrid and, you know, highway fuel economy of 22 mpg. And the Mercedes-Maybach GLS 600, which is, it's also technically a hybrid, mild hybrid, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. Also, fuel economy is almost identical to the Defenders, actually. So, yeah, the term hybrid is quite broad these days.
It is. But no, I mean, it is a lovely looking thing. I love the styling. It's got a lot of really nice features that remind you of the original Defender, but it's very modernized. I mean, if you're familiar with the Ineos Grenadier, I think it's called, which is an attempt to bring the Land Rover Defender.
I'm familiar with Grenadine, not the Grenadier. So.
This is a company
maybe
that
over some grenadine and some other mixed things mixed in. You can tell me all about it.
Yes, it's a company that was so sad that the original Defender got production stopped that they decided to make their own. But it just looks so old. I mean, it would have been great if they'd launched it in the 60s.
Well, it's a great video. That's the point. Go watch it. Go show all your friends and watch it again, and then watch it a third time. But for now, I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars, where I'll be sure to have pictures of Chris rocking on his brand new parking lot harbor boat. And Chris, thank you so much for another great podcast.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.